Okay, this is Wisdom of Solomon, chapter 17. We've been discussing a lot about idolatry. The Wisdom of Solomon, here in Wisdom, in these final chapters, he does a big build-up on the origins of idolatry. And part of the end of that, or the objective of that, is first to compare Israel and Egypt. Israel being encouraged to pursue the one true God, and Egypt being an idolatrous nation, worshiping many false gods or idols. Solomon discussed the origins of idolatry, and he also explained how the Egyptians, and he's already done this to a degree, and I think he'll do it a little more, how the Egyptians were punished by their own devices, that men are punished by their own devices. And then the Egyptians, in the case of the Egyptians, they were punished by the same things that they had worshipped. So men are punished by their own sin, or the consequences of their own sin. And that's part of the lesson here in the Wisdom of Solomon. But the main thrust is to compare the future, that the destiny of those who obey God and seek to follow him, and the destiny of those who remain in idolatry and refuse to acknowledge God. And because the Egyptians, and especially the Egyptian Pharaoh, the members of his court, the magicians that challenged Noah, to challenge Moses, that they refused to acknowledge God, no matter what great miracles had been performed, and no matter what great plagues had come upon Egypt. So their destiny is to suffer in destruction. So the paradigm is basically relative to this very day, where when Babylon falls and it's time for men to turn to Christ, or they better turn to Christ and hear the call to come out from among them, those who refuse to, as it's promised in Revelation chapter 18, will suffer her punishments. Those who continue in the worldly idolatry that the Egyptians had continued in spite of seeing the power of God, will suffer those punishments, those same punishments. And we'll see that in Wisdom chapter 19, where there's a comparison of Egypt and Sodom. That's the end of idolatry. The important message being that if men don't follow God, that they're going to end up like Egypt and Sodom, and there's no other choice. And that's all I have to say. Frank had something to say about chapter 16 last week, so I'm sure he could follow through with that now before he begins to read chapter 17.
Thanks, Bill. What I caught, chapter 16, it was verse, what would have been, 26. In order that your sons, O Yahweh, whom you love, may learn that it is not the productions of fruits which nourish a man, but your word which maintains those who are believing in you. And that reminded me of Genesis chapter 2, where, because I was doing a study of your commentaries, Bill, that all of the creatures dependent on the earth and on the oceans sprung forth from those places, but man was made by Yahweh, and he is utterly dependent on it. And it's also, you can connect it to Christ, where when he was talking with the Samaritan woman at the well, that he's the water that if you drink it, you'll never be thirsty ever again.
Absolutely. And believe it or not, even a lot of Judeo-Christian commentators, denominational commentators, have also caught on to that lesson in Genesis chapter 1, that all of the creatures of the sea and the land are produced by the sea and the land, but man is produced by God. And that's a paradigm that I think that Yahweh inspired and had Moses basically write into the book so that we would understand that.
And what produces Negroes? You know, where do they come from, Bill?
From corruption. That's why they don't produce anything good. That's why they have no use to man. They come from corruption. The Nephilim, the fallen angels. The other races, the non-white races, by their own behavioral patterns and by the existence that they have without the Adamic man, where all of the material things they've been able to acquire have only been on account of the Adamic man or the white man. Otherwise, they'd be living in mud huts and eating mosquito pancakes forever.
Everything has its origin.
Right.
And your origin determines your destiny.
Yeah, I got invited to a Judeo-Tard Bible study. It was this last Monday. And I tried to drop a few things. I brought up what marriage is with them, but still, it's just like it never goes through your head. Like back when I was a Catholic, it literally just never popped in my head. How do you get multiple races from one pair? It just, they don't think about it, so you're safe.
They can't think about it. The questions are too hard. The answers are too obvious. And if they think about it, it blows up their entire paradigm on the New Testament.
Yeah, it's a safety mechanism. But would I be good to start reading on 17, Bill?
Fine.
Okay. Wisdom of Solomon, chapter 17, verse 1. For greater are your judgments and hard to explain, for which reason uninstructed souls have wandered. Then the lawless, having undertaken to oppress the holy nation, captives of darkness and prisoners of a long night, were laid shut up under roofs, fugitives of eternal providence. For, supposing for their hidden sins to be unnoticed, with a dim covering of oblivion, being terribly astonished, they were scattered and troubled by hallucinations. Then neither did the innermost room containing them protect them from fear, but agitating noises sounded around them, and obscure apparitions with gloomy countenances became visible. And indeed, not any power of fire had prevailed to give light, neither did the quite bright flames of stars abide to shine upon that hateful night. But there only appeared to them a spontaneous fire full of terror, and being terribly frightened, they thought the things being observed worse than that which is not seen. Verse 7, but delusions of magic craft were laid prostrate, and a contemptuous rebuke of the pretense for wisdom. For they promising to drive away terrors and troubles from a sick soul, themselves were made sick from a ridiculous devotion. For even if nothing terrible frightened them, in the passing of beasts and the hissing of serpents, having been terrified, trembling, they had perished, even refusing to look at the air that from no place could be avoided. For cowardly is wickedness, condemned by her own witness, always takes hardships to herself, being afflicted in conscience.
Solomon is used.
Oh, go ahead, Bill.
Solomon is using the disparate fates of Israel and Egypt at the time of the Exodus as an example here, all the way through wisdom, on and off. And especially in these later chapters. And he's portraying the night of the death of the firstborn, all the firstborn of Egypt here. And he's asserting that they died from apparitions and fear and terror, hallucinations. Things like that actually killed them rather than anything physical. So we can't discredit that. The Bible itself doesn't elaborate much on that, except to say that the angel of the Lord had passed over the Egyptians and slew all the firstborn of Egypt, right? So this is an elaboration on the Exodus story. But Solomon is only about 450 years, 500 years removed from that story. So I'm sure that memories of it were still prevalent among the people at that time. Memories that had been handed down from generation to generation.
Verse 7, where it says, delusions of magic craft were laid prostrate. That means they abandoned their little magic and their rituals and all that stuff that they were doing. And a contemptuous rebuke for the pretense of wisdom. So they were rebuked for thinking they were wise by practicing these crafts. And those magicians who promised to drive away terrors from the sick, they were made sick themselves because of their idolatry. So that's the punishment of an idolater, is their delusions. They were punished for their delusions. And then they realize, oh, our idols are just fake. They're just delusions. They can't help us. So their magic craft were laid prostrate that night because they suddenly realized that their idols were nothing and couldn't save them, but they were still punished.
So it reminds me of when the Philistine idol, Dagon, was laid prostrate to the ark.
Yes.
What's a fugitive of eternal providence, Bill? Does that mean they're trying to flee providence, or does that mean they're a prisoner or a criminal of providence? What does that mean?
They were trying to escape the judgments of God. They thought they could escape the judgments of God. They thought they could defy God and not be judged and not suffer. They refused to recognize him as God, which Solomon had mentioned in chapter 16 or perhaps chapter 15. I might have the word acknowledge. No, I don't. Chapter 13. For indeed all men are vain by nature, which came ignorance of God, and from of the good things being seen, they were not able to know who he is, neither in the works did they take care to recognize the craftsman. I think there's more spots than that where he says something similar to that. However, that's the gist of it right there, is that they saw the plagues that came upon Egypt, and they saw the works of God, the works of the God of Moses, what he could do compared to what they could do with their idols and their magic. And their idols and their magic were laid prostrate, but they themselves didn't repent and change their attitudes towards Moses and the God of Moses.
Yeah, and the section near that where it mentions thinking that their hidden sins went unnoticed, you know, these Jews that run our nations, they fooled, you know, 99% of the white population. They're off scot-free for now, but it's not unnoticed, and I can't wait for the day.
Well, God can't see them in tunnels.
Is there like a cutoff depth? Is it like 20 feet? Probably in the Talmud. They probably know the exact depth.
Yeah, probably.
I'm sure they have a specific measurement. 666 feet.
I believe it.
Well, those tunnels in Brooklyn weren't hardly deep enough then.
Well, no, I think all those little boys would have been under 9, so it's not a sin anyway. We'll start on verse 11.
They spent too much time thinking about this one.
They had these mattresses. They basically acknowledged had blood on them. I wonder if there's going to be an investigation. Probably not.
Yeah, you'd think the FBI would want to investigate.
Well, didn't somebody post something about that in the Rocket Chat? Some Jew rabbi was on a talk show and he says, like, oh, yeah, we just put dead corpses on it for the ritual. We're trying to bring the Meshiach.
Yeah. Where is that in the Bible?
Yeah, where's killing people to bring the Meshiach in the Bible?
Well, he was real careful. He did a fantastic Jew speak. He didn't mention like how they get the dead bodies. He just said, "Yeah, we put dead bodies on them."
These fucking Jews.
He did insist it was people that died of natural causes. So when Uncle Morty dies, they're going to drag him down a tunnel and pull some rituals on him before they call the coroner? I somehow don't believe that.
Sling a chicken around a bit.
Yeah. It really makes more sense that when some little kid disappears that he's down there in that tunnel on that mattress.
There's somebody still probably slinging a chicken.
Yeah.
I cannot think of a Jew without just picturing one of them slinging a chicken over their head, regardless of what they're doing.
Okay, I guess on that note, we could probably resume with chapter 17.
All right. Verse 11, yeah. For fear is nothing but a betrayal of the resources of reason, and the expectation from within, being weaker, considers ignorance better than that which provides the cause of torment. But they, on a night that was actually powerless, and coming upon them from the innermost recesses of powerless Hades, sleeping in the same sleep, while they were persecuted by wonders of phantoms, then they were released from life by betrayal, for a sudden and unexpected fear had poured over them. Then, in that manner indeed, whoever at that time was there, falling, was Garrison, having been shut into a prison without iron bars. And Solomon, his words there are just beautiful. I mean, because that is a perfect description for just being racked with fear, is a prison without bars. You're just stuck inside your own inaction and fear.
Right.
And then verse 12, so what does that quite mean, Bill? And the expectation from within, being weaker, considers ignorance better than that which provides the cause of torment. Is that sort of like saying, you know, it's like, it's better if I don't know? Is God calling out that attitude?
Doesn't that describe most people today?
Yeah.
They'd rather remain ignorant of something rather than have to do something about it?
They'd rather suffer than and be ignorant of God. It's like Christ said, they won't come to me so that lest I heal them.
Right.
Hmm.
And this That's part here, reference. For fear... Sorry, Bill, go ahead.
Wow, that was a good reference. Go on.
For fear is nothing but a betrayal of the resources of reason. Well, if you had the wisdom of God, what is there to fear? Like, was it Paul that said perfect love casts out fear? It wasn't Paul.
John.
John, that was thanks, John, and I was just going to quote that, but you beat me to it, but that's all right. There should be no fear in the love of God.
Solomon, he calls Hades here powerless. That's pretty prophetic.
What? Which one are you talking about? Oh,
Verse 13. Yeah. That's absolutely prophetic.
Yeah, that's neat. It wasn't powerless at Solomon's time.
No.
Now it's powerless.
But it's powerless compared with the power of God.
Yeah. That's really
what are you saying is powerless, Noble? The power of the night? The power of what?
Hades.
Hades. Oh,
Hades,
okay.
Is powerless.
This powerless is twice. Sorry, yeah, there's powerless in there twice. I was looking at the first one. You know, also another verse that comes to mind is that no weapon formed against us shall prevail. So we shouldn't have fear of anything, any of the devices of the enemy. Yet people, a lot of normies are constantly, you know, they get caught up in conspiracy theories and they start to fear and they start to just, you know, the fear porn is so great today. And a lot of people block it out and they still won't turn to God. And if they would just turn to God and have that faith in God, we would have nothing to fear from these Jews, nothing they can do.
Right. We have to be dauntless, intrepid. Trepidation is always a failure because you're not putting faith in God and you're fearing what men may do to you when Christ tells us, do not fear what men may do to you. Now, eventually, we're all going to die of something, possibly, but we shouldn't fear what men may do to us. If we do, think about how many opportunities you'll miss to do good in your life if you're always afraid of what men may do to you. So we shouldn't fear at all what men may do to us. And we shouldn't fear at all about the wonders of nature. And that was what we saw in verses in chapters 15 and 16. In the will of God, even the elements can defy their own nature or betray their own nature. So the fire couldn't hurt the water or the ice.
And the water could hold the weight of a man.
Yeah.
And what's the worst thing a man can do to you? Kill you and bring you to Christ? How terrible.
Right.
Yeah. And having died an honorable death, you died for your God. So it's even better.
Verse 16, starting there. For whether any man was a husbandman or a shepherd or a laborer toiling in the desert, having been overtaken, he awaited that inescapable necessity. For with one chain of darkness, they all had been bound. Whether a whistling wind or a musical sound of birds in surrounding widespread branches, or a rhythm of water being driven with force, or a crash of hard stones being thrown down, or an unobserved course of leaping creatures, or a voice of howling of the roughest beasts, or a sound echoing from the hollow mountains, being terrified, it undid them. For the whole society shined with bright light and continued in works without disturbance. Over them alone there was a spread, a heavy night, an image of the darkness about to receive them, but they themselves were more heavy than darkness.
So the inference there is that the night in which the firstborn of Egypt had all died was longer than a night. And the darkness extended throughout the daytime of the Passover. Remember, the children of Israel had eaten the Passover meal and spread the blood of the lambs on the door lintels the night before, the evening before, which to me is when the sun is going down. It's dusk. It's the time of day that we would call dusk. That's what I believe the evening was. Tonight, and they were told not to leave anything to eat at all, so that would take some time. That's a pretty long feast when you're talking about whole lambs and a family, right? That's a pretty long feast. So they may not have finished eating in time for dawn when they had to start moving. So that night must have lasted into the next day, and Solomon describes it in that manner. So perhaps they had enough time to get a little rest, to get some sleep because it was still night. But then again, Solomon's saying outside of Egypt, it was still daylight, that the darkness was only over Egypt. Perhaps it wasn't even over the children of Israel. Perhaps they had lied.
What an incredible time.
I don't know if I'll ever do a commentary on the Exodus, but perhaps I'll do a highlights on the Exodus series or something like that.
That'd work. A highlights.
Yeah. Just to go through it and pick out the important topics or the things that should be discussed.
Because we're going to come out of Egypt one day, so it's relevant. Highly
it's relevant. Very relevant, yeah. Like, whenever I'm reading this in Wisdom, I'm just thinking, like, hey, what are we going to expect when we're released?
You know, just a thought on verse 18. I mean, it doesn't exactly portray this, but if you know, if you're around wild animals in the wild and you kind of come upon them, really, if you get terrified, they sense that, right?
Yes.
Kind of, it makes them think that you're prey, even if, generally speaking, you're not prey for them. So if you can remain calm, I mean, I've even seen divers that they can swim with sharks. As long as they remain calm, their heartbeat doesn't escalate, then the sharks will think that they aren't prey and won't attack them. But, you know, it's the same thing with bears and so forth. Usually when someone's attacked by a wild animal, it's usually their fault because of the way that they reacted when they realized the animal was near them. Reminds me of that. Being terrified, it undid them. Last sentence of.
Yeah, that's a good point.
That works the same way in a lot of sense with domesticated animals like livestock. If you're working with horses or cattle, and you get excited and start moving around excited or talking excited, they'll, you know, they can turn either panic or aggressive. If you're calm, you know, there's some cattle out there that if you upset them, they will turn very aggressive, and they can sense that from you. If you work them calm, move slow, then they'll stay calm. But as soon as you start pushing them, they'll freak out.
Go ahead, Joe.
Don't they say in America, don't run from a bear, because the bear will then know that you're it'll then chase you and kill you. So yeah, when you see a bear, you have to stand still, don't you?
The worst thing you do is run from it.
Yeah, you're supposed to look at it dead in the eye and stand still for a while and then back up without turning your back on it. And then after a few steps, then you can turn your back.
Yeah.
You know, that's a good point. That'd be like a Christian with no courage.
What are you supposed to, in Australia, what are you supposed to do with a koala bear if they start to like attack you or something?
Oh, you're just done. You're just done. Yeah, there's no hope for you.
Exactly. There's nothing you can do, James.
A koala bear.
Just gonzo.
You might think you can get a photo taken with them. Oh, look at me. I'm hugging a koala bear. That's what all you guys think, but they're nothing like that in real life, James.
They're really 400 pounds and ferocious as hell.
There are other animals too, though, like apes. If you're, I saw this documentary of this guy who was like studying apes. You can't look them in the eye. If you encounter one of them and you're out in the jungle, you have to pretend that you're just there eating, so you can like pluck some leaves and pretend you're eating them, and don't ever look them in the eye because they see that as a sign of aggression.
Yeah.
Is that the same with niggas?
Well, it kind of is, actually, because I know that niggers, they don't like eye contact, prolonged eye contact, right? Like, let's say you're walking down a street in Harlem or something, where I've been before, and a friend of mine who I was visiting who lived in that area, well, in New York anyway, was telling me, because just that's the way it is, like, don't make prolonged eye contact with them, but don't look away either. So you have to acknowledge their existence, briefly staring in the eye, but if you keep it going, then they feel like it's you're being hostile toward them.
You're challenging them. You are challenging them.
That'd make a good book, How to Act in the Jungle.
That's exactly right, David. That same thing happened to me at work today. I there's a nigger coworker, and I looked him in the eyes, and they got real fucking antsy.
I'll do it. I'll say, I want you to know that I want to crush you and put you in the dirt.
Well, that's what I was thinking. You can probably just tell him by the way I look at him. Like, he knows.
He knows.
It's probably fine what you're saying, Joe, on a one-on-one thing or so forth. But if you're in their territory and there's many of them, it's different, right?
You don't want a pack of apes.
It can be
cowardly forward, right? Apes. Yeah, definitely.
When I was in boot camp, I'm going to go looking for a picture I took in 2012. I was in, this was about a week before I met Melissa. I was in Jasper, Georgia, on my way north, and I stopped to see a friend named Tony Adams, and he lived on the mountains in the woods, and we're standing in his driveway talking, and I'm about leaving his house after two nights there. And we were standing in his driveway talking, and this big old bear comes down the road and starts walking down his driveway. And I just grabbed my camera. I had my camera in my hand, and I grabbed my camera and I'm pointing it at the bear, and I'm trying to get closer to him to take pictures. And by the time I took a picture, the bear turned sideways and he started walking away, and I was kind of disappointed.
Wow.
When I turned around, Tony was in the back of his garage thinking I was nuts. Here, I'll show you the pictures I took. I'll put them in the, I got four pictures. I'll put them in Kindred Clubhouse.
Yeah, nice.
I'll put three of them in Kindred Clubhouse.
Will you send me those, Jack? I totally want to see those bear pictures.
They're a lot more.
Oh, dangerous. Yeah. Frank's not in Kindred Clubhouse yet.
Oh, really?
Wow. We got to put Frank in Kindred Clubhouse.
He should be in there.
Well, what are you doing, Frank?
What's your handle, Frank? Is it just Frank? I can't remember.
I got it.
It's just Franklin.
Oh.
It's done.
On that eye contact topic, there was a nigger that got in trouble for not breaking eye contact with the company commanders in boot camp. Because you're not supposed to look them in the eye. You're just supposed to, like, look straight forward. And he would always get called out because no matter what we were doing, he'd always be, like, mad-dogging all of the company commanders. And they would just get pissed. But he wouldn't even blink. He would just stare right at them like a fucking gorilla.
That's called mad-dogging. I can see why.
What
are
we on?
Yeah, go ahead, Frank.
Am I good to start next chapter?
I reckon, yeah.
Okay. Wisdom of Solomon, chapter 18, verse 1. But upon your saints there was a great light of things, while hearing the voice of them, but not seeing the shape of them. Then, because they had not suffered those things, they were blessed. And because they did not injure those having first done wrong, they gave thanks, and for their differences they begged kindness, in return for which you had provided a flaming pillar, both to be a guide for the unknown journey and a harmless sun for a generous hospice. Indeed, the others, worthy to be deprived of light and imprisoned in darkness, having imprisoned your sons confined, by whom the uncorrupt light of the law was about to be given unto the age, and them being determined to slay the infants of the holy ones, then for one child being exposed and saved for a reproach, you have taken away, and a multitude of their children, then, with like passion, you destroyed in violent water. That night being made known beforehand to our fathers, in order that, knowing with certainty, having faith in the oaths, they would rejoice. But your people is anticipated both the salvation of the righteous and the destruction of the enemies. For in that which you punished those opposed, you distinguish us having been called. For secretly, the righteous children of good men sacrifice, and in harmony dispense the divine law for the saints to partake equally of the same things of both good and of danger, while already singing the praises of the fathers. But in response, there sounded the discordant cry of the enemies, and it carried a pitiable sound of the singing of dirges for children. Then, servant and master, being punished together with like penalty, also the commoner suffered the same things with the king. So they all, with one accord, in one expression of death, had innumerable corpses. Then, neither were those living enough for which to bury the dead, since in one moment the most honored of their race were destroyed.
Well, the firstborn sons. There was actually a pharaoh. I described the Exodus 2, Tutankhamun, I think Tutankhamun 3, it might have been Tutankhamun 4, I forget. Not Tutankhamun, Thutmose. Thutmose 3, Thutmose 4, I forget which one off the top of my head. I think it was Thutmose 4, was Pharaoh of the Exodus. And he had a son that died about 1450 BC, right about the time of the Exodus, that it's unexplained why he died. Of course, nobody in, and he was supposed to be the heir, and instead his second son was his heir. And nobody in mainstream academia wants to connect that to the Exodus account, but it falls right into place for the Exodus account. And why this son died is not recorded. Nobody knows. The point here is that all the Egyptians were punished equally, the least of them along with the greatest of them, just like we often read in Scripture and in the New Testament, the least of them along with the greatest of them are going to die. So that's what we see here. Solomon just expounded on it in slightly different language.
One expression of death.
Yes, they all died in the same expression of death. The same cause and event and effect. It's really poetic, the language of wisdom to me. From my perspective, it was difficult to give it justice. Let me say that.
Well, going back to the start of chapter 18, I love this part where it says the unknown journey. So we have this unknown journey, and Yahweh's leading them through this unknown journey with a pillar of fire, a guide for the unknown journey, and a harmless son for a generous hospice. Well, the harmless son there, that is, that works in English in a different way than it would have worked in Greek or in Hebrew.
Right.
Because we've got son and son, you know, the son of God. So a right. harmless son, that is, I would say that's certainly Christ. But I love that part about the unknown journey. That is so poetic.
And we'll sort of have an unknown journey when we come out of Babylon. We know what's going to follow when we come out of Babylon. We know that Christ is going to return, but we don't know how long after. We don't know what's going to happen when we're out there. We don't know how Yahweh's going to protect us. We just got to go out there and rely on him.
In faith,
like the
pillar of fire. Like, we're on an unknown journey, Noble, because we don't know exactly what's going to happen and how it's going to happen. All we have is the word of our God, and we just got to follow his pillar of fire through life, like be faithful to him on our unknown journey, eh?
Yeah. And I mentioned this last week, but when you read Isaiah chapter 4, it seems to suggest that there might be pillars of fire again.
And that's why Peter saw it in 1 Peter chapter 1.
I also love how... Sorry, Bill.
He talked about the old world being destroyed by the flood and the new world being reserved unto fire.
Yep. Now, I also love how we have the uncorrupt light of the law. So we've got this law of God is uncorrupt and it's perfect.
Right. I'm sorry, it's 2 Peter chapter 3. But the heavens and earth which are now, he has spoken about the deluge and the world that was then. And we saw the same word here in chapter 17 in verse 19, for the whole society shine with bright light. That's the whole world, but I translated it as society purposely, the word cosmos, because it wasn't the whole planet. And we use the world today to describe the planet. But no, the whole society shine with bright light and continued in works without disturbance as darkness was over Egypt and the sons of Egypt were being destroyed. So that same word is used in the same sense that Peter uses it in 2 Peter chapter 3, whereby the world that was then being overflowed with water perished, but the heavens and the earth which are now by the same word are kept in store, reserved unto fire against the day of judgment and perdition of ungodly men. So even Peter foresaw basically what Solomon described of Egypt in wisdom.
Wow, that's a great cross-reference. That's a great one being preserved by the word and one being destroyed by it.
Yes. And Egypt was destroyed by the word and Israel was preserved by it, and we're going to see that same thing once again according to all the promises of Christ, that his people will be preserved by the word and all the others will be destroyed by it, and there was no more sea.
And the nations, how can that be anything other than racial? Oh,
I'm sorry. The nations and which are not written in the book will go to the lake of fire. I'm sorry. Go on, Joe.
Oh, I'm sorry, Bill. For some reason, I hear you and your light wasn't on. Yeah, sorry about that.
I paused for a second, but as soon as I started talking, you started talking. So it was just a timing thing. Go on. Man.
Well, I just wanted to say, like, how can that infants of the holy ones not be racial, Bill, since it's like the offspring. Offspring is racial of the holy ones. That's racial, isn't it? So
it's absolutely racial. And the holy ones are those who were separated and dedicated to God in the loins of Isaac and at Mount Sinai and the giving of the law. Only the children of Israel could possibly be holy in the sense that the word holy is used in scripture. They were determined to slay the Egyptians were determined to slay the infants of the holy ones. Moses was exposed in the river about 80 years before the Exodus. He was one of many children exposed, but the point Solomon is making here that was that one child who was exposed, Yahweh saved, for reproach to the Egyptians. So Moses was an example of someone who was on the edge of death and was saved and used to go on and do great things.
Much like Christ, when he was brought to Egypt, when Herod sought to kill all the children.
Another analogy being made here is that Moses was saved out of the water by that princess of Egypt, but the Egyptians, many of them, who were destroyed in the water when they tried to cross the Red Sea and proceeded.
That is awesome. You know, another one is, Bill, you know how the people of the world are like the sea or the waters flowing out of the serpent's mouth, and and we're saved out of the waters?
Yes. Yes, that is good.
Yeah, yeah. And in Exodus, the Red Sea is divided. And in Habakkuk, you see a description of the waters being divided by the army, and that's the army of God.
Good night, James. Yahweh bless.
We'll see and you Christ. Soon. Christ will divide the nations.
Yahweh bless.
Yep.
Hoping to have it open for at the end of this month. I'm sorry, guys.
Well, I'd like to join in. Hopefully I can. I'd like to see. Listen to it anyway.
I'm sorry for the disturbance.
Yeah, just the way like God divides the waters at the time of Moses, and then Christ divides the nations at the end of the age.
Yep. Yeah, that's a great way to look at it. That's really true.
Already singing the praises of the fathers. Is that like turn the hearts of the fathers to the children and the hearts of the children to the fathers or something like that?
Well, verse 7 is the same promise we have to look forward to today. By your people is anticipated both the salvation of the righteous and the destruction of the enemies.
I don't want to see the enemies destroyed. Can't we all go to heaven?
Yeah, the Judeo-Christian paradigm is so wrong. So Solomon wrote, "You distinguish us having been called. For in that which you punish those opposed, he punished the Egyptians with the water and the fire and the darkness. You distinguish us," meaning the children of Israel, "having been called." Only the children of Israel were called. So the righteous children of good men, those men must be a reference to the patriarchs. It's the whole message is distinguishing the races. I mean, even though the Egyptians and the Israelites or the Hebrews were both of the same greater wider race, they were still two different races in the ancient sense of the word, where a race is actually a subsection of a wider group of tribes or a nation. One man's descendants are a particular race. So Adam's descendants are a particular race, but then Abraham's descendants are a particular race within that race. So the whole message here is a racial message. The Egyptians were being punished for who they were, and the Israelites were being saved for who they were.
And then the Egyptians all became niggers anyway, so.
Right. They evidently, they ultimately were overrun and willingly mingled with blacks.
So now they are the darkness.
Well, we even saw here chains of darkness, and that's really similar to Peter's language. We saw that earlier, I think, in the last chapter. And yeah. Now all their children are in chains of darkness today.
That's a good point. It's like they didn't want to accept the light, and then they were tormented by the darkness, and now they are the darkness, in chains of darkness.
Yeah.
And it's unforgivable. It's chains that can't ever be broken.
Yeah. You want to keep reading, Frank?
Yeah, we finished chapter 18.
Okay. Verse 13. For they all believing disbelief. Oh, hold on. I messed up. For they all being disbelieving on account of sorceries, Upon the destruction of the firstborn, they conceded a people to be a son of God. Indeed, all things being embraced in quiet silence, and the night being amidst in its own swift passing, your almighty word out of the heavens, from the royal thrones, as a severe warrior sprung up destructively into the midst of the land, a sharp sword bearing your ingenious command, and standing filled all things with death. And indeed it touched the heaven, but tread upon the earth. Then indeed apparitions of terrible dreams immediately confounded and unexpected terrors loomed over them. And one having been thrown here, another there half dead, revealed for what cause they had died. For the dreams which had been troubling them had indicated this beforehand in order that not being ignorant of what reason they suffered terribly, would they die. Then the trial of death had also touched the righteous, and destruction in the wilderness came upon a multitude. But not for long did the wrath abide. Indeed, hastening the blameless man fought in defense, prayer the weapon of his own ministry, and providing a propitiation of incense, he resisted the wrath and put it to an end, by which circumstance exhibiting that he is your servant. So then he overcame the anger, not with strength of body nor action of arms, but with a word he subdued the punisher, recalling the oaths and the covenants of the fathers. For the dead already having fallen upon one another in heaps, standing in the midst, he resisted the wrath and parted the way towards the living. For upon the garment reaching to the feet was the whole society, and the glory of the fathers carved upon the four rows of stones, and your majesty upon the diadem of his head. Unto these did the destroyer yield, since for them it had feared, for the trial of wrath alone was sufficient. And that those four rows of stones on the chest of the Levite priesthood, is that what that's referencing, Bill?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, and he's saying that that's the whole. Well, I guess that would, is that the Greek world cosmos there that society comes from, Bill?
Yes, he's actually defining the cosmos right there. The world of the Bible is defined right there.
And so one man, recalling the covenants of the fathers, he parts a way for the living. Surrounded by death, there's a way to the living. And it's like in Genesis where we have the path of life is preserved by a sword which turns every way to keep the way of the tree of life. So I would cross-reference that to Genesis and a sword which turned every way to keep the path of the tree of life. There's always a way for the living, and it's in the covenants and promises of God and in his law.
I wonder if this passage here in Wisdom was Paul's inspiration when he called the word of God a sword in Hebrews.
It's a magnificent sword, I'll say that. A sharp sword bearing your ingenuous command. So it bears his command and it fills all things with death.
Yeah.
That's analogy, incredible. I'm sorry. That analogy, the word of God to a sword, is found in many other places in the prophets.
Oh, okay.
And especially in the Revelation.
Right, it comes out of Christ in his mouth.
It's Isaiah chapter 49, and he has made my mouth like a sharp sword. In the shadow of his hand he has hid me and made me a polished shaft, and his quiver he has held me.
I know a verse we all love, Bill. If I wet my glittering sword and my hand takes hold on judgment, I will render vengeance to my enemies and repay those who hate me.
Yes.
And praise Yahweh.
In the Psalms. It's like four times in a Revelation. No, three times. Out of his mouth goeth a sharp sword. I will fight against them with the sword of my mouth. Chapters 1, 2, and 19.
It just makes me love Yahweh even more, because he's just so awesome with his his sword filled with death and judgment and stuff.
Yeah, our God is mighty.
Mighty to save.
Yes, yeah.
Ephesians chapter 6, verse 17, and take a helmet of salvation and the sword of the Spirit, which is the word of God. When these denominational Christians talk about the Spirit, they don't know what they're talking about. The Spirit, the law is spiritual, Paul said in Romans. In Ephesians chapter 6, the sword of the Spirit is the word of God.
Oh, that's a great cross-reference.
Yeah, spiritual doesn't just mean I have feelings, does it, Bill?
I'm sorry, I'm beating my monitor because I got him that time. A mosquito keeps flying in front of it.
So spiritual is like when you feel butterflies in your stomach. That's like being spiritual.
I feel spiritual. That's not what it means, though, is it, Bill?
No, spiritual. The law is spiritual. If you're of the Spirit of God, then to be spiritual is to keep his law, to follow his word. That's the reflection of his Spirit. That's as close as we're ever going to come to understanding the Spirit of God is to keep his law and to study his law and recognize it. So David said all the time in the Psalms, I mean, not all the time, but quite often, that he meditates on the law. Because men should seek to understand the law and should to know the law. And then your spirit will resonate with his spirit, as Paul sort of explains in Romans chapter 8. Or maybe it's chapter 7.
What if I go to a rock concert, Bill, and I take magic mushrooms and I'm like peeking and I'm like, man, I feel so spiritual.
Yeah, that's not a spiritual feeling. That's just being full of yourself in the delusions of your own mind.
Yeah. So spiritual. I was wearing tie-dye clothes.
Yeah, I might get drunk and feel spiritual for a couple of minutes until I barf and pass out. No, I don't do that, but I did when I was a kid.
Yeah. Yeah, we're just joking. Now, that's what a lot of people, that's what the world thinks is spiritual. You know, and they'll have mystics and stuff like that. They're all in this new age crap. And they think if they do psychedelic drugs, that's spiritual. Or if, and a lot of Judeo-Christians sort of seem to follow after that. And they think feelings are spiritual.
I think 99% of Judeos think that. I think it's the overwhelming majority. I've never seen a Judeo who doesn't.
Yeah, you know, the scripture says to remain sober-minded. Not necessarily sober as if you never had a glass of wine. I'm having a beer now. But to be sober-minded, you don't want your perception of reality to be altered by chemicals or pharmaceutical substances or anything like that. That's sorcery. That's actually sorcery. You don't want to alter your perception.
It's coming upon us, and they'll start like running around and like aching and like having convulsions, and they'll start like having a seizure, and they'll say, "Oh, I'm spiritual."
Yeah. And Yahweh would just laugh at them, like, "What the fuck are you doing?"
Well, I knew a Judeo girl one time where she came up to me and she said that she had prayed really hard all night and God wanted her to get a tattoo of her favorite verse on her forearm.
There you have it.
That's what their version of spirituality is. It's just, yeah, I prayed hard enough and God said I can do what I wanted to do.
Yeah, God told her to do it though, Frank. That's what you're not getting. God spoke to her and said, get it. It's like a prophecy from God. Get a tattoo. She's now a prophet, by the way. God spoke to her, and the prophecy was, get a tattoo. And then, yeah. You know, why didn't she tell us all that and write it down?
It's pretty incredible, too.
It was fulfilled immediately, yeah. Joe. That's pretty impressive.
I mean, God, he's been hiding his face for 2,000 years or more, but now he's finally unveiling his face, and the first thing he does is tell her to get a tattoo.
If we were to judge, maybe she'd have got staffed immediately and died.
I'm not going to believe she's a prophet until she starts having a seizure on the floor. Then I'll believe she's a prophet.
Yeah, because that's what all the prophets did. Like, every prophetic book, it opens, and Isaiah had a seizure, and Micah had a seizure. It always opens that way.
You'll never be that spiritual noble. You'll never get there, mate.
I try, you know.
You just got to feel it, man. You just got to let go and feel the vibe, and then you'll have a seizure. Then you'll be spiritual. But know, until yeah, you I learn gotta, to let go and feel the vibe, man.
I got to loosen up.
Yeah, we're really stuck up, guys. We should just let stuff happen. You know, live and let live.
Yeah, that's the problem. You guys are too caught in your ways, too racist, too bigoted. If you just let go and let it all go and just, like, tune into the frequency, man, maybe then you have a seizure.
Just feel the vibrations.
Yeah, forget about the law of God.
Into your head.
Forget about all that stuff. That stuff's too mean. You guys have just got to let go, tune in, you know, maybe do a little LSD or, you know, magic mushrooms. Maybe that'll help a little bit, help you guys, you know, chill out a bit, you know, and have a seizure.
And let them know.
Chill out and have a seizure. It's like a contradictory sentence. Chill out and have a seizure.
You better watch out, Joe. Well, you've been talking. I think I heard a koala bear sneaking in your window.
They don't live everywhere, man. They don't, like, roam the country. They live in trees, hey, just so you know.
I think I could see it, going back to being serious, I think I could see a far vision in verse 13, like a type, or I know it's not a prophetic book, but you can still see these things, for our own release coming out of Babylon, for they all being disbelieving on account of sorceries. Well, that constitutes a lot of people today.
Yeah.
The vaccines and such. Upon the destruction of the firstborn, they conceded a people to be a son of God. Well, the Jews descend from Esau. Esau was the firstborn. And when all of his children are killed, people are going to concede that we're the children of God.
When Christ died on the cross, the Romans conceded that he was the Son of God.
Oh, yeah, and he's the firstborn of many brethren. Yeah, that's better. I like that more.
I would
reckon Solomon with the prophets.
Yeah.
Without a doubt, even though he's not called a prophet in the New Testament.
Oh, yeah.
Not specifically, I mean, that context never arose.
No, I know. There's like prophetic types in Ecclesiastes and Song of Solomon. I was just, you know, making it clear that I wasn't trying to read every single word here as a prophecy.
But even Christ mentioned the wisdom of Solomon, which isn't necessarily a reference to this book, but to his collective works, certainly.
I really like what you said there, Joe. Yeah, upon the destruction of the firstborn, Christ, they conceded a people to be a son of God, conceded him to be a son of God.
Well, ultimately, once again, they will have to concede that there is a people who is a collective son of God.
Yeah.
Meaning all of these white Judeo-Christians that are stuck in stupidity.
They won't like it. They'll be weeping their teeth.
Yeah, and they'll have to concede it when all the Jews are destroyed and they come from Esau, the firstborn of Isaac.
Well, everybody's going to love niggers if Trump picks Tim Scott to be his nigger, I mean his vice president.
All right.
Tim Scott is so intelligent. Come on, Bill. Come on. You have to look at his speeches and listen to his rhetoric. This guy can change the country.
Some Jew is writing those speeches. He's not smart just because he might be able to pronounce most of the words.
I've never actually heard him speak, so I don't know. But I'm sure it's just more like booga daga beep or something.
Well, Trump name dropped him the other night. I watched it on Newsmax on an interview.
Wow.
Are they going to try and get all the conservative types to like have a based nigger that they all cheer for?
Oh, yeah. It's going to go. I'm sure that I would bet. Like, my gut feeling is that he will pick Tim Scott to be his vice presidential candidate. I mean, I might be wrong. He might pick somebody else, but if he gets that nigger, then he'll get like 5% of the nigger vote.
Only 5% of niggers vote anyways.
You guys want me to keep recording?
Yeah, but 4% of those niggers
vote. Yeah, this is relevant, the wisdom, David.
Okay, yeah, we could cut it here, David, I guess, because we're going to go over parts of chapter 18 when we finish 19, I think.
Okay.
That was